Welcome to the Clubhouse Podcast. I'm Shane Bacon. We have a few days to digest what went down on Sunday at the Masters. A crazy, crazy final run, obviously, at Augusta National. I'm finally done with the pimento cheese sweats, and I'm happy to bring in a good friend of mine who you really listened to pretty much all week if you had your computers up. Grant Boone, part of CBS Sports online coverage, part of CBS Sports, and part of Golf Channel. You can follow him at Grant Boone. That's all one together. And Grant, first, we appreciate you coming on. How are you feeling after all this?
Well, probably a little better than Jordan Spieth, but still trying to wrap my head around it. You said we have Tuesday to make sense of it. We need a couple of days, don't we?
I think so. And you and I had a chance to chat Sunday night following the final round. I mean, you called the Amen corner action. You called most of the coverage on Thursday and Friday that everybody was listening to when they were at work, not working. But we both had that, you know, did you just see a ghost look on our faces following all that? As you're calling the action live on Sunday, you see Spieth unraveling, you know, this kind of unprecedented moment for Jordan Spieth over his career. How hard is it for you to stay in your lane as a broadcaster and not turn into a fan who wants to see history made?
That's a great question. I will tell you that that I don't pull for any one particular golfer over another, but I do pull for great stories. I think you ask any basketball or football or hockey or baseball play-by-play man or woman, and they're going to tell you they want a great game. They don't want a 30-point blowout in basketball. They don't want a rout. They don't want the Broncos Seahawks. They want Patriots Seahawks, you know? So you do want great stories. And so as you talk about staying in your lane, I was with Billy Ray Brown, the longtime PGA Tour winner and now broadcaster like myself, CBS Sport and Golf Channel. And we have one eye. We have all the different angles. You know, in our broadcast position at Amen Corner, we've got the different camera angles for all the different shots that are being hit there around Amen Corner. But we also have one monitor that's on the CBS television broadcast. So we were able to, out of the corner of our eyes, between commercials and during, you know, the random walk up to the ball or whatever, when we weren't talking, we were able to see what was going on elsewhere. So staying in the lane for me was, you know, let's don't say here's Danny Willett for birdie at 14. Oh, wait a second, that's not name and corner, you know. So what really I found fascinating in those crucial moments on Sunday was that you can see, as historic as a collapse as it was, or a choke, or whatever term you want to use, as huge as those few moments were, you then begin to see, it's really not that hard. It's not that hard for it to turn around. The bogey he made at 10 was one in which almost anyone could have made. He did hit his tee shot a little bit further right than he wanted. That left him in the bunker at 10. Then, as I heard from someone who had followed him around, our buddy Joe Gilliland, who had followed him around on Mondays, he was playing a practice round, he hit a bunker shot from that same bunker over the green at 10. So naturally, he leaves it 15 or 16 feet short for his par, then misses the putt for par. Then you get to 11, blocks his tee shot again. Hard tee shot, make no mistake. But it was the second time that he'd been over there in the trees. So he punches out, almost jars his third. And think about this. Can you imagine if that thing spins in? I mean, how much did it miss by? A few inches?
It just short it of spun it. It was all over it. I mean, You mentioned, you know, you mentioned Willett's on 14. You know, when he hits that great shot, and you're trying not to call the action there. I was on social media saying, if Willett makes three on 14 and Spieth makes bogey there at 11, you know, we've got ourselves a golf tournament. And then he hits the shot, and it looks like, oh well, he's going to save par. The guy's an alien. I mean, he just can't make a bogey. You know, when it seems like he can't afford one, and then he goes on to miss that putt there.
Exactly. And so it's really interesting about before Willett's group, it was the Cabrera Rose group. And that was the first group of the day that began the day within six shots of the lead. And when Rose got to Amen Corner, if I'm not mistaken, he was two over And at the time, he was probably, Spieth was probably four or five, maybe. And so he was six or seven shots back. And so what Billy Ray and I, what I asked Billy Ray, and what we wound up discussing as we watched Cabrera and Rose is, how do you, as a player, are you still thinking you're in it if you're Justin Rose? And so we got into this whole discussion about just keep stacking as many birdies as you can up there. And if it's not enough and you lose by six, as it looked like everybody was going to, you tip your cap, you say, this guy's a freak and good on you, and I'll try to get you at Oakmont, you know, but you stack up the birdies just to make sure that in case he does something like he had done the first couple of days, that you're at least in position to capitalize. Well, by the time Spieth got to, it was really cool, because by the time Spieth bogeys 10, it's 6-2, Spieth over Willett. But by the time, as you say, by the time he gets to the tee at 11, Willett's on 13. He gets, Willett hit the green at 13-2. Willett two putts, made a very nice putt there. He also made a terrific putt at 12. In fact, his tee shot at 12, it hung about 3 feet to the right of that front bunker. I'm telling you, he was inches away from it spinning back down the bank and into the water himself. Matsuyama had hit it up there Saturday when the hole location was right in the middle. And those are the only two balls I saw in that exact same spot all week. And Willett was there, ran his second shot from off the green about 5 or 6 feet past, made the comebacker, made the birdie at 13. So when he makes the birdie at 13, it's now 6-3. Well, by the time Spieth is over the putt at 11 for par, as you say, it's 6-4.
Right.
And then Spieth bogeys. I'm telling you, My whole point there is, when you see it happen, you start to think, yes, you certainly can't see the 7. I'm not saying you can see the 7 coming at 12, but you can see how it tightens. And so Billy Ray and I had actually been talking about that for about 45 minutes before it happened. It reminds me, Shane, I know you're a fan of all sports. You know, the Red Sox, they get the stolen base in the ninth inning from Dave Roberts. Then they get the tie. Then they win that first game of the ALCS. Now it's 3-1.
Right.
When you see it happen, you start to think, yes, I can totally see this turning around. It never does. And so sometimes we write teams off at 3-0, but you think, what would one win do?
Absolutely.
And most of the time when it's 3-0, it turns into 4-0.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a
sweep. It reminded me, I went to University of Arizona, and this is a brutal thing to think about myself, but I've thought about it, compared it to the Arizona-Illinois game, you know, when Arizona was in total command, was going to go to the Final Four, and it was just every little thing that could go wrong did. So I want to take you back to 12T, okay?
Yeah.
I've heard a lot of people, nobody watched the 12th hole more than you did the entire week. I mean, you were on it the entire time. I mean, you're seeing every shot that's being hit there. It seemed like Spieth played that shot and that hole a little quicker, especially the tee shot, than he had all week. Did that seem like something you noticed?
I noticed him a little. It's, again, he may say, oh, you're crazy, you're making that up, and maybe I am. I noticed him a little quicker around Amen Corner a couple of times. On Saturday, he was seemingly in control of the tournament. He hits a tee shot that for him couldn't have been any better, long and straight. McIlroy was playing with him, pulls his tee shot left, tries to hit a little hooded, you know, low running shot. Well, it ran all the way into the water left, and McIlroy made double. Spieth from the middle of the fairway hits his second shot, and as soon as he hits it, says, I bailed on it. And so now he's over right of the green. And it was the whole location that it's not technically front right because it's an odd-shaped green, but it's as front and as right as you can get, you know, that Saturday hole location, which means if you're right of the green, you're going to have a very, very different – it's the farther away you are from the green, the harder the shot's going to be because you've got to almost die it on the fringe and then have it trickle on. And if it trickles on, it will get all the way to the hole. What people usually do is – they'll either put it all the way 20, 25 feet past the hole down the slope, as Spieth did, or they'll leave it right there in the fringe. You just don't see many people get it exactly right because it's such an exacting shot. Well, Spieth got up there, and McIlroy's making an abject mess of the hole, okay? But Spieth kind of gets up there, and it's a shot that requires a lot. It requires a delicate touch, and he kind of walked up and just hit it. And it goes bounding down the slope, 25, 30 feet. Well, then he three-putted. He got way too aggressive with that first putt. He would have been far better off just lagging it. But, you know, he's in grind. I mean, he's in master's mode where he's dominated and runs it four feet past the hole. And I'm telling you, you'd rather have 10 feet below the hole there at 11 on that with that location than 2 feet above it just about. Well, he misses it. In fact, made about a five-footer coming back for double.
Right.
So I thought he was a little hurried there. I didn't notice as much of a hurry at 12, but wasn't it fascinating to go back and hear him later say, I wasn't disciplined? The deal with Spieth is never that he's going to wow you with his ball hitting. Now, it's better than we sometimes think it is because we tend to compare it to Day and McIlroy, right? But he's tended. We don't think of him as he's a better ball. He's a way better ball striker than we sometimes think of it, but that's only because he's such a great putter. I used to say this with Mark O'Meara. O'Meara had stretches where he was a tremendous hitter of the ball, but O'Meara was always more about just finding a way to get it in the hole, and I think about that with Spieth. So it's not that Spieth could hit a bad shot. That's not what was stunning. What was stunning was that we thought that, A, if he was anything, he was disciplined and made the right decision. We, as he always says, we made the right decision. And then, B, that he was impervious to pressure. Not that he didn't ever feel it, but he didn't ever succumb to it. And that's exactly what he essentially admitted.
Yeah,
I mean, after the round.
And you know what I kept pulling from this when it was all happening, when the train wreck was occurring on 12, what I kept thinking was, if you go back and watch, you know how they replay the 2015, 2014 Masters, they cut it down to 30 minutes, and you can see it on CBS, and you can see it on Golf Channel at times. You know, when Spieth talks about his tee shot on 12 last year, all he talks about is how he learned so much from 2014 when he hit it in the water. You know, he talks, I learned you can't do this. You've got to hit it in the middle of the green. And he does it. So, but my thing on that especially was that was a bad golf swing. He made a bad golf swing on the tee and it went in the water. I want to take you to his drop. You were there all week. Did you see anybody that hit it in the water go over to the area he went to and try to hit that 80-yard pitch shot?
Yes. We saw, and let's just remind folks, you have some options there. At 17 at Sawgrass, for example, you're either going to re-tee it or you're going to play from the drop area.
Right.
There really are no other options. At Augusta Nationals 12th, you do have some options. You can say what angle do I want to take? What yardage do I want? Because it's a yellow hazard line. You can go back as far as you want, including all the way to the tee. So there were players. If you were to look back, you couldn't see it now because Augusta National is so immaculate. They fill those divot holes immediately. But you would see guys who had played from a variety of places. We saw Ian Poulter very early in the day, almost hole his third. In fact, he spun it right past the hole and left himself an uphill putt for a bogey. And later Spieth said, that's why I went to that place. I wanted to land it, have it bound forward, and then spin back to the place where it landed. That was the plan. And instead, he just absolutely hit. Well, he hit a shot that probably would resemble a lot of the shots that were struck Monday in the media lottery day at Augusta National.
That's exactly right. I've called it the worst golf shot he's probably ever hit in his career. I'm sure he would probably agree. You know, it's
the worst golf shot that almost any professional has ever hit. That was everyone's hit horrendous golf shots who's played the PGA Tour. That is as bad as I've got to believe as any pro has ever hit.
And so, you know, he makes that number there. He makes quadruple bogey to be.
By the way, in 2014, when he hit it in the water, he got up and down for bogey stay in it.
Right, and you know, I've said this a lot. I wrote about it on FoxSports.com. A lot of people aren't giving Spieth credit for staying in it. Now, he wasn't in it on that shot, But he hits the next one in that back bunker and gets it up and down. And as you know, not an easy up and down from the bunker, right? I mean, a lot of people didn't do that.
That was amazing.
Yeah.
That was a what if that was his third?
Right.
What if he just said, I'm going to take my medicine. I'm going to, in fact, he used the term, I'm going to take on 11 when he hit it in the trees. He said on Sunday, he said, I'm just going to take my medicine and punch out. What if he had said, I'm going to hit it in the back bunker. Worst case, I make six and we're in this thing. But you know, it's easy to say now. He's not thinking six. He's
right.
Thinking, let's hit a shot. Actually, you know what? At that moment, he really wasn't thinking much at all.
That's
I think
right.
He admitted as much.
Yeah, and I mean, he said...
He did stay in it. You're right. He stayed in it.
And then we get to 13. And I've compared a lot to Rory in 2011. And Rory falls apart on 10, bogeys 11, doubles 12, hits it left on 13, and really imploded. I mean, in every definition of the word, in every way that we've seen chokes happen in golf, that was Rory on that 4 and 5 hole stretch. Spieth has it, and Spieth admitted, I can bogey 10, I can bogey 11. Those are really tough holes, probably two of the four toughest holes at Augusta National. Gets to 13, hits a great tee shot, hits it up there, makes his birdie. I wanted you to, you know, were you surprised at the bounce back he had so quickly after having that complete meltdown on the par three?
No, I wasn't at all. In fact, I was expecting him to bounce back at 12 because when he made double at 11 on Saturday and you're thinking the wheels are coming off, he's down to 3 under. He then he retained the honor with McIlroy because they both doubled. He hits it right above the hole, 18 feet. McIlroy hits it to about 7 feet right after him. Spieth drains it for it. So he goes 6-2 at 11 and 12. So I frankly was expecting, in fact, that was my setup. Trying to build the drama right before he pulled the trigger. I said, Spieth needs a bounce back. Can he get it? Tee shot at 12. Boom, and it just hits in the water. So I wasn't surprised. Once he hit the tee shot at 13, he was in the go zone. Now, here, let me go back to something that kind of speaks to what I think was just a week of odd decision making and odd occurrences for Spieth. Saturday, hits a tee shot right down the middle. He's got 240 yards. Okay, 245. He's probably had 205, 210, something like that to carry. Hole location on Saturday was back left. Okay, so up on that tier. He's got 245 all the way to the hole. Well, you don't want to get it all the way to the hole because you don't want to risk going back over the back of the green on with that hole location because it's tough up and down. He deliberates, and we had 90 of the most glorious seconds. It was some of my best work. I said Zippo for 90 seconds. And it's Michael Greller and Jordan Spieth deliberating whether or not to go for the green in two. It's Saturday. He's got the lead. He's just made birdie. He's back up by two. And they're going back, and he's, you can hear him say, it's not an easy par, even if I lay up. Because, you know, if you lay up, now you've got to try to either skip it up the hill. And if you try to skip it up there, you run the risk of it going over the green if it doesn't grab. Or most likely, you hit it up there and it kind of spins back a little bit. And even if you try to deaden it, it doesn't take much. You're going to err on that side. It's going to roll all the way down the slope, and you're going to have 30, 40 feet for birdie. So they're really going back and forth, and he was upset. He was concerned about the wind, and he said, you know what? He said, if the wind was totally laying down, I think we go for it. But I think the call here is to lay up and try to make birdie that way. Well, he laid up. Billy Ray Brown was really surprised. And he's right in the middle of the fairway, perfect position. And it did bring memories back of Chip Beck and totally different situation. That was Sunday, 93, not Saturday. And he wasn't playing with the lead. He was chasing. But you got the idea of fortune favors the bold or whatever. Of course, you could argue that he was too bold on Sunday, and that's
right.
What got him into trouble at 12. So the point is, if you make the shot, you're a genius. And if you don't, you're an idiot, you know, and isn't that the way it is for goofballs like us who cover it and try to give our opinions on it. So at 13, he hits the – I really thought – when he was in the fairway, I thought, here's a chance for him to get all of the momentum back, not all of the lead back, but to get all of the momentum back. Hit a second shot up there somewhere, you know, on that lower level, give yourself a putted eagle, and all of a sudden you would be back to 3 under par with an eternity, what would seem like an eternity to play. Instead, he makes, well, of course, at the time, Willett was 4.
Right.
Let's say that. So he was 3 shots back. If he makes eagle, it's 4-3.
Right.
See, Willett was at 15 at the time. And instead, he just tugged it a little. Understandable. Almost everybody did it. And so he's now, it kind of trickled off the back. And that is a really, really tough up and down. And he did get it up and down. He made his putt, and he got it to 2. So now it's 4-2. And Willett missed his birdie at 15, so it's still 4-2. So I'm not surprised he came back, but I'll tell you this. I was thinking this going into the week. I was thinking about it with McIlroy, and you may have some memories that I haven't thought of. You don't find very often a player have a lead, blow it in the final round, and still come back and win. You just don't see it. McIlroy, Greg Norman, even as late as 15 on Sunday in 96, Norman had an eagle pitch that rolled right over the edge. If that goes in, maybe, but by then he's already behind.
Right.
So Norman didn't give up. It's not like he gave up, but by 16 when he hit the water, it was over. Spieth, you know, I thought if he eagles this, man, he's got a shot. But the reality is you just don't see very many people blow a lead and then get it back. The one exception I can think of off the top of my head, and I'm sure there are others, but you get my bigger point, it doesn't happen often.
Right.
McIlroy at Valhalla.
I was thinking the same one.
Had the lead going into Sunday.
That's what I was thinking as well.
And at one point, Fowler, I think, had the lead. Henrik Stenson had the lead. Mickelson was right there. And McIlroy hit that low scud missile on the 10th that he even said wasn't very well. You know, what did he didn't hit it purely.
Yeah, he said he necked
he
it.
He just nuked it.
Yep.
He necked it 290 or whatever, 310. We should all have necks.
I know.
Like Rory McIlroy.
I wish we could hit it like that, but he bounced back. And I saw on Twitter.
So he did come back and win. Yeah,
yeah, and he came back and won that thing on the 18th, obviously, with a little bit of controversy as well. You compared on Twitter. You said, this felt a little bit like the 2007 Masters. Can you kind of expand on that?
Yeah, it got me to thinking. 2007, first of all, the weather conditions reminded me a lot of 07. Chilly, windy, difficult to score. You had Stuart Appleby, really good player in position. He was leading going into the final round. Tiger was playing in the final pairing with Appleby. It was the whole week was just chilly and cold, and it was Easter weekend, and Zach Johnson was around, certainly. It wasn't, he kept himself in it and played well, but Johnson was a couple of groups ahead, posted the number, and that was the first time ever that Tiger, he didn't have the lead going into the day, but he did get the lead on Sunday. Early Sunday, because Appleby got into trouble pretty early.
Right.
And Tiger, it was the first time Tiger had ever had a lead in the final round and not converted. So, believe me, there are plenty of differences. But it with the weather, with the high scores, you know, Zach won at +1. It was the first time in 51 years since Jackie Burke came from 8 shots back. It was the highest winning score in 51 years, +1. And the dominant figure, the guy you were expecting to win it, didn't get it done when he had a chance to get it done. In fact, I think Tiger even dunked his second shot in the bunker at 17, that front bunker, like Spieth did that day.
Spieth says not even close, is what he said when that ball left his club.
That's not even going to come close, yeah. And so Tiger didn't blow the day like Spieth did at 12. But the point is, think of the narrative. Now the dominant guy has the lead. He's going to go on to win like he always seems to do. And then out of nowhere, seemingly comes a guy to win it who was an unexpected winner, but not a shocking not a shocking winner. It wasn't that Zach Johnson was someone you'd never heard of. He played on a Ryder Cup team the year before. He had already won multiple times on tour. He was a guy who had been on tour for about 2 or 3 years. Willett's been out there for a few years now. Willett had played better in majors than Zach had. Willett, I think, you know, obviously was in contention at the Open last year that Zach won. So it wasn't that Willett, it's like, Danny Willett, who's he? Well, he's 12th in the world. Right. Now, Zach was 56th in the world. I went back and double-checked. He was 56th in the world. So, as I say, some differences. The point is, it's not that Zach Johnson won a Masters, although if there were any that you'd think he'd win, that might be the one you least expected. But the whole week was unexpected. You didn't expect it to be cold or windy, or didn't expect Parr to be a good score, or for Jason Day and Bubba Watson and Jordan Spieth to shoot 41s on the second nine during the tournament. It was a week for the unexpected. And so Danny Willett is a perfectly deserving and not altogether surprising major champion. If I told you that in 2018 Danny Willett was going to win a major, you'd say, that's about right. Yeah, he's 12th in the world. He's trending that way and maybe got there a teeny bit earlier than we might have thought. Same with Zach Johnson. It's just that the guy we expected to win didn't.
Right. And Willett, I mean, you know, when you go back, for people that obviously don't pay a ton of attention to Danny Willett or the European Tour, I mean, this is a guy won the Omega European Masters. I mean, he won the Omega Dubai Desert Classic. He finished third at the Cadillac Championship. He finished fourth at the Nedbank Championship and in the Dubai World Tour Championship. I mean, this guy top fives and top tens all the time in worldwide events. He's a really good player. We just don't see him much. So, obviously deserving. You being there on 12 around Amen Corner, to me, it's just so cool to get your perspective on those moments. And I wanted to see if you could encapsulate everything that happened on 12, everything that happened with Jordan Spieth in that moment, in that 12, 14, 16 minutes of that hole going through in the quadruple bogey. If you had one word to describe what you were seeing, what would you pick there?
Can it be a hyphenated word?
Absolutely.
Hyphenate this one. Career changing. Don't misunderstand what I mean by that. Career changing can be good, bad, or neutral, but it is career changing. Tiger Woods failing to hold the four-shot weekend lead at Hazeltine was career changing.
Right.
What happened to him later that November at Thanksgiving weekend, that was career changing. Now, he came back and won eight times. I'll tell you this. If I had to pick one guy to win at Oakmont, well, first of all, picking anyone to win, unless you're Shane Bacon, who picked
right.
Danny Willett.
My only time insane. Ever getting it right.
By the way, I had a good friend of mine send me a text on Wednesday night saying he was in a Masters draft. He said, give me some names of some guys. I don't know anything about golf. And so I gave him, he said, how about a sleeper? And I said, how about Danny Willett? So he sent me he buzzed me on Monday and said, thanks for your picks. I won both the overall and the individual because we all had four picks.
Tell him you need a cut of that. Tell him you need a bookie cut of 5 or 10%.
Oh, I mean, there's no question. Absolutely. There will be a variety of ways he can pay me back. But career changing. It is career changing. And this goes back to what we opened this podcast with. I root, and I know I'm not alone, I root for great stories. I root for history. I want to see, and this is selfish of me, and it probably isn't totally the right thing always, but it's like I'm selfish. I want to see history on my watch. I want to see the next Jack Nicklaus. That was why there was a part of me that did pull for Tiger Woods to do something heroic. And so I wasn't pulling for or against Danny Willett. I wanted to see something spectacular. We saw something spectacular. It was spectacularly awful for Spieth. And so there was a part of me that did want to see history. He would have been the youngest in 90 years with three majors. He would have been the youngest in 90 years to successfully defend a major. Now what he is just really, really good. But he's not divine. He's mortal. I don't want to see mortal. I see mortal every day when I look in the mirror. I want to see the divine. I want to see the sublime. And this was this went from the sublime to the ridiculous in two swings.
It's the same feeling, and I think you'll probably agree with me on this. I'm watching the British Open last year at St. Andrews, and Spieth misses that par putt on 17, hits an amazing pitch shot on the road hole to give himself even a chance for par,
Oh, no
misses that
doubt, no
putt,
doubt.
gets to 18, hits the big old pool that almost goes into the stands on the left and on the widest golf hole in the world, and then misses that
Horrendous tee
shot in the
shot.
Valley of the Sin. And that moment when that putt, and again, hit a good putt, it's just an area that only one human ever can hole out from. He hits
Right.
that putt, and it was just all of the air went out of the sails. And again, we had a good playoff. We had Zach Johnson trying to win at the Masters in St. Andrews and Oosthuizen and in Leishman with a great story with his wife and all these good storylines. But it was just that feeling like, well, history's done now, you know? And you just were a little bit bummed for no reason other than we're selfish at times because we want to see greatness. Now, I wanted to ask you, we've talked Spieth, we've talked this Masters. You've been at the Masters since 1996. Was this, it's not the best Masters ever. I mean, I think of 11 or 05 or 04. I mean, there's so many Masters that have been amazing in the last few years, but was this the most surprising Masters you've ever covered?
Schwartzel birdieing four straight holes was surprising. As fate would have it, I was blessed because I was doing featured groups that year, and once we did our morning group of whoever Mickelson and or whoever else it was, they said, "We're going to give you Choi and Schwartzel," and I was like, "Okay, I don't get to choose. I just take whoever they give me." And keep in mind, there's five, six, seven guys with a chance to win this thing. I'm thinking, give me Tiger, give me Jason Day, give me Adam Scott, they give me Schwartzel and Choi. And I got to call four straight birdies to win the first guy ever to do it. So that to me stands out as surprising. I'd say Trevor Immelman kind of holding off Tiger and Brant Snedeker, not Snedeker that had ever been in that position before at that point, but Immelman was a surprise winner. For sure. And the Zach Johnson thing certainly was surprising. Again, not that he was a shocking winner, and he's validated it by the way he's played since then, even before he won the Open, he validated it, in my opinion. But then he caps it off with a second major. And so there are years where there are surprises, but this wasn't surprising. This was shocking.
There you go. That's
This,
probably
you know, I,
right.
it, my, my, fir my first and last Masters have, to me, very different in so many ways with Norman and Spieth, but both had shocking, almost historically shocking Sunday finishes and 12 in Amen Corner was right in the middle of it. Here's one thing I remember from, in fact, I followed Faldo and Norman around. I was working for a radio network back then, and I followed those guys around every hole. And every hour would go and file a radio report of about 30 or 45 seconds with an update. And as I listened back to those later, it was like, Greg Norman, 18 holes away from becoming the first Australian to ever win the Masters. He and Faldo about to tee off coming up in 20 minutes. I'm Grant Boone for USA Radio Network. You know, then the next hour, Greg Norman's lead is down to four. He still leads East Bay. Greg Norman's lead is down to two. Greg Norman's lead is down to one. Greg Norman is losing the match. You know, it's pretty funny to go back and listen to him hour by hour. But on 11, when Norman is leaking oil royally, he hits the best second shot of the day, to my recollection, spins it below. Now, the whole location was over on the left near the water that day on Sunday. Spins it almost like Spieth hit his approach, missed a short putt for missed. It was like a four-footer and missed it, and then missed the comebacker. So he's got 4 feet to birdie and right the ship, and who knows if he goes on at that point, buoyed by that bounce back. Instead, he three jacks it, and now it almost seemed inevitable that he would hit in the water. So my first and last Masters, 20 years apart. I witnessed at least what I can recall as the two most shocking collapses.
So I wanted to
Yeah.
transition quickly to we've had a couple of days. Danny Willett has probably not slept very much, probably having
No.
a pretty good time in his life right now.
I
He
would imagine.
did retweet a picture of him and Spieth in Butler Cabin, and it's the famous picture that people have been sending. Spieth has the blank look on his face. It almost looks like the straight-faced yellow emoticon on your iPhone. just staring off into the distance. Has to be the most uncomfortable Butler cabin moment ever, besides maybe when Mickelson congratulated Casey Wittenberg with the missed bro hug. But, you know, Willett retweets this. Somebody had said we should put this picture up in Butler cabin next time, and Danny Willett retweets it. I want to say, was that a big deal, no deal, or kind of a deal?
I told you this privately. My guess is he was 7 or 8 Heinekens, into his post-round celebration. That's a guess. He may not be a Heineken man. I'm not sure, but they now need to be a sponsor of this podcast.
That's exactly
by the way,
right. Since
that.
Hey Heineken, but, since some Heinekens, we'll take them down. That's fine.
Or at
We're
least
okay
at least a case of Heinekens, exactly. But I would say one of two things could it could be three things. It could be that he didn't really know what he was doing. He's retweeting everything. He retweeted a million things during that stretch. The other thing is, I know what the person, who by the way is wearing underwear hitting a golf shot in his avatar, so let's not overthink what this guy's doing.
That's right.
Not that all of us haven't done that at some point in our lives. And I would say that that person clearly, in my opinion, clearly meant to say, look at the face that Jordan's making. Isn't this hilarious, the look he's giving?
Right.
Willett could have simply thought, it's possible that Willett could have thought he meant, let's make this presentation of the green jacket the program cover. Hey, I'm getting, not even thinking about speed.
Right.
Hey, I'm getting the green jacket. Yeah, that would make a good program cover. Good one. Or maybe he really did try to rub it in. I would be shocked, and I've been shocked before, I would be stunned if Danny Willett, in the aftermath of the biggest moment of his life, is trying to rub it in to Jordan Spieth.
Right.
I would have to hear Danny Willett tell me. I would have to have him admit it before you could convince me of that.
I totally agree. Okay, so I'm asking you two.
And by the way, on that note, this is the biggest non-issue ever. This idea that Spieth wasn't gracious enough. Give me a break. You mentioned green jacket ceremonies. To me, what I thought of was Palmer in 61. Palmer doubles the 18th. He's the defending champion. He's about to win his second straight green jacket in third in 4 years. He doubles 18 and then has to go and present the green jacket to Gary Player, who on that very day, in fact, April 10th of 61, became the first international winner of the Masters. So to me, those are the two most uncomfortable green jacket presentations. And if the guy is vertical, then whatever face he makes is passable, because how that guy could even stand there and not be completely beside himself or in tears is a miracle.
And you know, I was thinking when Dustin Johnson came out after the Whistling Straits debacle with the bunker, and he came out, he went and took a shower, I believe, and he came out and talked to the media for a few minutes, and I was like, He didn't have to do that, obviously. And he came out and talked to the TV. And I mean, you know, this is a guy that has to be fuming. I mean, he had to have been, if not fuming at himself, caddy, rules official, the world. You know, and he comes out and talks for a few minutes. And I thought that was very impressive. He did it. I agree with you 100% on Spieth. I think he's going to be totally fine. He's going to take a few weeks to recover from this. He said it's going to be tough. Of course it's going to be tough. He had his chance to win a second green jacket in a row and really put his stamp as the best player in the world without a doubt. And he wasn't able to do it, and it was because of a couple of bad swings. But I wanted to ask you, a big deal, no deal at all, or a little bit of a deal, Rory McIlroy's birdie-free round playing alongside Jordan on Saturday?
I told somebody, it's funny you say that, I told someone yesterday, our mutual buddy Robert Lucetich, I said that Spieth's collapse on Sunday on the second nine, 5-shot lead with 9 to play, and you lose by 3. I think it bails Rory McIlroy out for a weekend that is almost that's really difficult to explain and understand. McIlroy began the weekend 1 shot off the lead. You know, a pair of 71s, albeit in very tough conditions Saturday, very scorable conditions. On Sunday, a pair of 71s, as it turns out, would have gotten into the playoff. But anything around par Saturday gives him a great shot. And I'll tell you this, being where he was, even after the 77 wasn't out of it. He was only 5 shots back. And I thought, yes, I could see a 65 or 6 from Rory McIlroy. Absolutely. This is definitely doable. And instead, he had another over par round and was never, ever, 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 ever a factor on Sunday.
Which you know, was surprising,
if he plays the first 7 holes, 8 holes in 3 under?
Right.
All of a sudden, he's 1 under for the tournament, and now he's there and able to capitalize if Spieth stumbles. And I think Spieth's debacle at 12. I really think his career changing debacle at 12. I think it bails Rory out for a really, really disappointing and kind of deflating weekend. And now you're getting into a guy like McIlroy who's now been at this thing for a while. It's hard to win the Masters.
Right.
It's hard to win.
Finally, I wanted to ask you this. You said you had a great story about your first Masters, and I figured it'd be a good time to talk about it. So, 1996, you talked about Fallon Norman. Of course, that's an amazing story in and of itself. But you mentioned you had something post-Masters that occurred to you that I can only imagine has to be a fairly entertaining situation. So, take us through 25-year-old Grant Boone?
Yeah, I'm 25-year-old Grant Boone. 1996, that would have been 20. Six. I was going to be 27 later that summer. So yeah, I was 26 years old. I was working at a radio network in Dallas. I kind of topped out as far as I could go there, and got credentialed to do to follow the Masters. I was based in Dallas, and got credentialed to cover the Masters. My very first one. Had grown up watching it. My favorite tournament, like so many, and went to the Masters and met up with a good friend of mine who was also a member of the media. And while we're walking around, he says that they have a media lottery. I said, "What are you talking about?" He says, "Yeah, they pick 40 or 50 members of the media to play Augusta National Monday morning." I was like, "All right, this is candid camera. I'm being punked here. This is long before
they're not letting us out there on the golf course.
There's no way. Why would they?
Right.
You know, it was, and he said, "No, I'll show you where it is. So you go and you throw your name in the hat, and maybe you'll get chosen." Well, I didn't have my golf clubs. I didn't have anything except a 2 o'clock interview on Monday afternoon in Atlanta with CNN Sports. That's how long ago it was. And this guy, Jim Walton, nice enough to give me an interview. I knew I was going to be there. I had my flight booked at 6:30 or 7 in Atlanta to fly back to Dallas on Monday night. So I would leisurely drive back to Atlanta a couple of hours. So I throw my name in the hat. And sure enough, Saturday morning, they had the names on the board. Here are those who've been chosen to play Monday morning. They give you an envelope, and inside the envelope, it says, "Be at Augusta National. Congratulations, you've been chosen to play Augusta National Monday morning. Be at the front gate at 6:45 a.m. So Saturday at the Masters was a blowout. Norman is winning this thing by miles. And so I'm following the Masters and following Norman and following, I went out to the golf course and phoned in my reports, but man, the only thing that mattered at that point was finding some golf clubs.
You had to go rentals?
I didn't have my clubs. And I didn't even think that they would even have rentals at the golf course. So I went to a local golf shop, rented some clubs for whatever it was. Sunday happens. And it's the absolute worst scenario for everyone except Nick Faldo. And Norman collapses. So in a daze, I'm thinking, I've got to get my golf. I don't have any golf shoes. I've got to get some golf balls. I went to where anyone would go when they're looking for the finest in golf apparel and golf equipment. Where else but your local neighborhood Kmart? So I show up at 6:45 at Augusta National, and in my mind, this makes sense. I've got a rental car and all this. I play it. We get there at 6:45. Even if I don't go off till 7:15, 7:30, play 4 hours, hop in the car, drop the clubs off, hightail it for Atlanta, change clothes in the car, and then the interview at 2, bingo. What possibly could go wrong? You show up, and you go when they tell you. You're not going to barrel your way up to the front and say, "Let me play." You go when you're just amazed that you're even there. So they start calling out names here, and they didn't call my name. 7:30, 7:45, 8 o'clock. They still haven't called my name. I'm trying to kind of peek over the guy's shoulder to see where my name is. I don't see it. 8:45. is 9 o'clock. And now I'm like, I'm toast. I can't get in 18 holes and still make it by 2 to Atlanta. So now everyone listening to this is saying, how do you even consider keeping this interview at CNN? It's a no-brainer you do this.
Right.
You've got to.
That's what I'm thinking right
so
now.
So I call the guy at 9 o'clock, call Jim Walton. I figure he's at work by 9. I call him. I say, Jim, this is Grant Boone. I know we're scheduled to meet at 2. Is it possible you have anything later than 2 o'clock, maybe 4 o'clock or so? He said, well, why do you ask? I say, I have a chance to play Augusta National this morning. And there's silence on the other end for like 10 seconds, which doesn't sound very long, but like on a phone call, it's like forever. He says, and you're still thinking about coming to this interview? And I said, yes, Jim, I really think this is, I could be an asset to CNN Sports. I really, really think that I could really help. And I think we could be a good fit. So I'm Grant, I'm sorry. After I meet with you at 2, I'm in meetings the rest of the day. I have nothing the rest of the day, but Grant, you've got to play. You and I can meet anytime. You've got to play Augusta National. I said, no, Jim, you've given me the interview. I'm going to honor that, and I'm going to keep it. I'll see you at 2 o'clock. He said, well, okay, I'll look forward to seeing you, but I really think you should play. I said, I'll see you at 2. So at 9:30, the guy says to me, you can go off 1 now, or you can wait until your turn comes up and go off 10. So I said, looking back, you just scrap the whole thing and say, I'm going to play all 18. But at the time, I'm 26 years old looking for a gig. I say, I want to get in as many holes as possible. So I go off 1. I play 9 holes. And again, just like Norman, spin it off the green. Same hole location this Sunday, by the way. Although they didn't mow the greens that morning, thankfully, or else we'd still be there from 1996. I spun it off the green, picked my ball up, walked off. And hopped in the car, changed clothes, took the clubs back. Well, you say it's 2 hours from Atlanta to Augusta. Really, it's 2:20. And by the time I get to the parking lot, go through Atlanta traffic, which this just in, there is. And by the time I get to his office, it's 2:35. So now I'm sweaty. I'm embarrassed. I'm late. He's very gracious. He says, come on in. We sat in his office for less than 10 minutes. He took the tape that I'd brought him, these bulky old 3/4-inch videotapes with all of my finest work on it. He says, I'll take a look at it. And, and if we like what we see, I'll give you a call. Never hear from him again. Not that I should have. It was me who wanted the interviews. Right. It wasn't like I was a finalist for something. But so I walk off and then years later, 2004 at Whistling Straits. 2004 is a big year to cap off this story. 2004, I'm at Whistling Straits at the PGA working for Turner and doing PGA.com par 3 coverage. They tell us we can play. I knew ahead of time, actually. We could play the Monday after the PGA at Whistling Straits. Well, it was my kid's first day of school. I played 9 holes at Whistling Straits and walked off and headed back and got an earlier flight to get home so I could be there when they got home from their first day of school. So that meant that I am halfway toward the walk-off Grand Slam.
I'm trying to think. We got and a new Pebble front
wait.
Nine.
I can't wait to walk off after 9 at Media Day at the U.S. Open and the Open Championship.
That's exactly
That's all
right.
I need for a walk-off Grand Slam. But the final coda to that story is that later in 2004, I was very fortunate to have become friends with a member of Augusta National. He brought me and my uncle Pat Boone, the singer Pat Boone. We played Augusta National. We played 45 holes in October, and it was plus the par 3 course, and it was magnificent. And so I finally did get to play the second 9 at Augusta National.
Some years later, that's an incredible story. Again, I'm not sure if I think you're a complete idiot for not playing the whole 18 or if I respect you honoring the interview more. I love thinking about both, but that is so amazing. It's just, it's one of those things when you look back on it, you go, what in the heck did I just do?
believe me. I will say this. And first of all, I think human consciousness has evolved to the point that we're less about the either or, and we're more about the both and. You can be a complete idiot, and I am. But you also, and you can be honorable. I really did feel like, what would I feel worse about? Missing a chance to possibly get a better job, you know, or miss playing Augusta National. And in reality, probably I should have said, Jim, could we speak on the, could we visit on the phone, you know, or something like that. And of course, then I thought back later, it sounds kind of funny, but I think it's also, there's an outside chance this is true. Why would a guy heading up a sports broadcasting network hire someone who doesn't take advantage of the chance to play Augusta National? He must have thought, if he knew anything about sports, he would cancel this interview and play Augusta National. Clearly, he knows nothing, which was not totally true, but you know what? It all worked out.
It all worked out. And let me just tell you, I think you did a fantastic job all week long. I always think you do a fantastic job with everything you do. It's been a lot of fun chatting. I really have enjoyed the ups and downs and the craziness of the last 72 hours or so. I mean, you know, from a 22-year-old making history to us talking about Danny Willett and what happened to Jordan Spieth. I think that the buildup, I think we're 64 days from Oakmont, and the buildup there will obviously include both of those names quite a bit. I appreciate you coming on so much. And people can find your work and find you all over the place. Where will we see you next?
Yeah, I've got several events for Golf Channel coming up. I'm doing web.com tour and some LPGA and some PGA tour. Our web.com tour domestic coverage begins in Evansville later this month, the United Leasing Championship. Defending champion probably won't be there, Smiley Kaufman, who played in the final pairing on Sunday. And then I'll do some LPGA events. I'll be doing the memorial for PGAtour.com. Of course, you've got this crammed in schedule because of the Olympics. And by the way, with all of this, with all the talk of Spieth, you know, really not managing his schedule as wisely as he could have, that's going to really come into sharper focus as the year goes on. When you've got all of these big events compressed, I really think he's going to have to not play some events that he feels obligated to play, like the Valero, the Colonial. He feels obligated, like he owes it. And by the way, here's my parting thought on Spieth. We've heard a lot of players through the years, Shane, say that when they lost, they felt like they let down, you know, their wives or their kids or whatever, or their coaches or, you know, friends. I really think that's part of what's going on with Spieth. He is such a, of course he's not married, but he's such a wee guy. He is so closely knit with his family. Michael Greller is more than just a caddy for him. Cameron McCormick is a dear person to him. He is a wee guy. He is a team guy in an individual sport. And I really think that's some of the sadness of this for him. I think, and I don't think he, I think he needs to be careful overdoing this thought, but I do think there is an element with him that he let his team down.
Right.
And I think it's going to be interesting to watch how he rebounds from that. Because, no offense, I really don't mean this as a knock. I don't think Tiger ever once thought, I let down Steve Williams or I let down anybody when I lost at Hazeltine or any of these other chances he had. It was, I made a mistake. I blew a chance to win a major and get closer to Jack. So I think it'll be fascinating to watch Steve rebound from this. Love the kid. You know, Jason Day's had some chances to win majors late and didn't, but you wouldn't really say he's given it away. McIlroy and Spieth have now given majors away, and all it means is that they're human, and now we'll see how they respond. But it sure is going to be fun to follow and to watch.
Well, I'm excited for it. Again, thanks so much for coming on. We'll have you on maybe after the PGA and chat a little bit more golf. Okay.
Sounds good. See you, Shane.
Well, that was a lot of fun. It's been a crazy, obviously, 2016 Masters, crazy last couple of days. Unexpected finish, but still one we'll be talking about for a long, long time, I believe, and one that leads us into not only the rest of the PGA Tour season, but a really, really compact major run that'll start at Oakmont, where we'll be, and We'll be pumping out a lot of podcasts from there as well. But that'll do it from us this week. You can, of course, follow us at the Clubhouse Pod. Use the hashtag ClubhouseSB if you want to send us anything, or if you want to send us any thoughts, suggestions, questions. I've had a few questions on where we can find the podcast outside of iTunes. If you have those, send it over to theclubhousewithshanebacon@gmail.com. I'll respond to all those emails you send over. And that'll do it from Augusta. So have a good week, and we'll be back next week.